For Tuesday, February 19th, 2008. Welcome, members. Welcome, everyone's here. A reminder, please turn off all cell phones, PDAs, Blackberries, and anything else that will cause the sound system.
And the exit is on the left.
Exit on the left. In case of a crash landing, the oxygen mask will drop from the ceiling. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1092A and ask Senator Hatch to come forward while our administrator reviews the bill for us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have before us three new amendments and then the bill that was circulated previously. Would you like me to do the lengthy description of the bill?
I would just want you to do the kind of highlights of the bill, if you would, and then we'll start on testimony.
I'll do my best. Requires a person filing a petition when a youth first makes an appearance before a court alleging jurisdiction in a juvenile court to notify the youth's resident superintendent, the superintendent's designee, or, if known to the prosecutor that the youth is in a private or charter school, the principal of that school within 15 days from the petition. It outlines the specific criminal conduct for which notification has to follow. Requires the school administrator to inform school employees and school subcontractors within 48 hours if they receive the notification. It requires a similar notification if the charge is dismissed or set aside. Those are the highlights, I think. Senator Hass can certainly fill in.
Thank you very much, Senator, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. Mark Hass, Senate District 14. Senate Bill 1092 is a crime prevention effort to keep employees and students safe in Oregon schools. Technically, it amends the juvenile code to require notification when a delinquency petition is filed in Oregon. That's a fancy way of saying that a record that is public about what a juvenile is charged with should be provided to a school district. So what this means to teachers and school employees is that they will have a better idea of who is in their workplace so they can perform in a safer environment. This information is shared with staff on a need-to-know basis. It is absolutely no different than the rules regarding health care records or special needs of students today. Thousands of Oregon students have medical issues ranging from diabetes to HIV under this same rule of confidentiality. So this bill is focused on the most serious of crimes and only those that involve harm to people, harm to animals, and those involving weapons and drug dealing. It does not include minors in possession, smoking marijuana, traffic tickets, that sort of thing. It will also require school administration to seek out records when a student transfers in from out of state. And this is critically important because of policies in other states, most notably in California, in which students who get into trouble are told they may avoid prosecution if they leave the school system in California or go to an alternative care school system. So for many of these juveniles, it's a good deal, and they end up in a classroom staying with Uncle Peter in Ashland, and their new teachers have absolutely no knowledge that these individuals have recently been involved with a shooting, an assault, or a sex crime. And it's important to note that when this information is received, there's no punishment, there's no discipline, there's no sanctions whatsoever. There's simply the knowledge that will better equip school counselors or teachers to educate these individuals in a safe, practical, and responsible way. It is no different than laws that we already have in place. Some of you may already know that it's already a law to provide notice to the school district when charges are filed in adult court against a juvenile, when a juvenile is sentenced in adult court, when a juvenile is released from the Department of Corrections custody, when a juvenile is released from juvenile corrections facility, when a juvenile in Oregon Youth Authority custody transfers into the district, and when a juvenile is in the custody of the Psychiatric Security and Review Board. All of this is already in statute now, and all this bill does is add pre-adjudication notice. Why do we need this? Well, we had testimony on the other side from some very credible teachers in urban and rural settings, and I know you will hear similar testimony perhaps later this afternoon, but they will tell you about some very scary and nerve-rattling events. Fortunately, the testimony we heard of those events, none of them were tragic, but you might ask yourself, how this would play out if there was a violent attack on a teacher or a school employee, and say someone was killed. there would be questions, and people would want to know what happened, and they would want to know if this individual had a history, and if he did the school know about it? So that's the tragedy this bill hopes to prevent by erring on the side of safety and prevention. I mentioned this is a crime prevention bill, and the thing about prevention is it's not sexy, it's not glamorous, and it's hard to tell when it's working because you don't notice when things aren't going wrong. Now, I want to end here, but I know that you will probably hear from some opposition to this, and without telling their story, I just want to say that the thrust of that opposition is based on the notion of innocent until proven guilty. And as a trained journalist, no one is more sympathetic to that notion than me. But I also know the records we're talking about here are public records. You could go down to the Marion County Courthouse today and take them off the shelf. A reporter could go down there, take them off the shelf, and put them in the newspaper tomorrow. And I also know that we're not talking again here about discipline or punishment. We're simply saying, let's take these public records and disclose them to a small number of professionals in the name of crime prevention. And finally, members, this is on the newsstands this week, Time Magazine, How to Make Better Teachers. And it is a good read, but one of the things it mentions is one of the detriments to keeping good teachers is because of violence in our schools, in high schools in particular. So I just think whatever we can do to make this workplace safer is a step forward. And I think it makes sense, and it's not unreasonable to, in this case, err on the side of safety.
Thank you, sir. Members, any questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, I do have several questions, and I don't know if it's best to direct them at the senator or not, but I'll go ahead and take a stab at it here. And if it's something that, Senator, that you'd rather somebody else answer, that's okay. On page 2 of the bill, starting at line 28, and I hope you have it in front of you, it talks about that except as otherwise provided in 192.490, that a person who sends or receives notice under this section is not civilly or criminally liable for failing to disclose the information under this section. And there's a number of other sections that have that same language. But what I have found fascinating about this, and maybe you can help me with, is that earlier it will say that the information shall be given. So on one hand, there's a directive that, and it's a requirement that the information has to be given, but then it says, but you know what, if you don't tell anybody, it's okay. You're not going to face any sanctions. You're not going to face anything. Can you help me understand that?
Well, the goal, Representative Crummell, was to make sure there's just no liability anywhere. And I forget the phrase, right of action was inserted in there, so that there is no liability if confidentiality is broken, that while people will always have the right to sue, this in and of itself is not a liability.
Okay.
I might also mention that 12 other states have adopted a very similar law to this, and that has not been the problem. Confidentiality is not a problem now. I mean, there are, you know, issues of abusive homes that children come from, and all kinds of very, very personal issues. And to my knowledge, that of all the problems we have in our school system, that has not been one of them. My better half is in the school system, works with children who have autism. And occasionally when I'm asking her about something, she will even tell me, well, I can't, you know, go into that, or you don't need to know his name or something. And then I pin her down.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Thank you, and I can certainly appreciate that. On the third page, starting at line 15 and going through lines 23, it talks about if a student comes in from out of state, and that the school administrator of the Oregon school should contact the youth's former school and request any information about the student. And then it goes into talking about that once the information is received, that the that if there's if the youth has a history of engaging in activity, then the school administrator will notify school employees and subcontractors, and many like the school bus companies and that sort of thing. So my question is how is this going to occur? I mean, kind of what do the logistics of this become? Because I'm wondering if this doesn't sort of create a nightmare. And then what happens if the state that the student has come from does not allow for disclosure of the information? What then?
To my knowledge, they just have to request it, and it's not binding that they get it. There's again no liability put on the school districts for those kinds of circumstances.
Follow up, Mr.
Chair. Yes.
So along that lines, then, if they if the school district said, "Hey, sorry, but our state law doesn't allow for disclosure of that," then really the administrator's responsibility is now taken care of because they've documented, hopefully, that they have requested the information and that the sending school has refused to give the information. Am I correct in that?
Representative Crummell, that's my understanding. There are some technical experts who are going to be coming up here who might correct me or answer that. But to my knowledge, the history of that sort of thing is good in school districts sharing.
Sure.
Representative, I'm going to move on to Representative Greenlick. I'll come back to you. I just want to make sure everybody gets a chance to ask questions. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you. Senator, welcome. I understand there are likely to be some proposed amendments discussed here, or maybe not, but I wonder whether you've had a chance to look at those amendments and whether you have any opinions on them.
I briefly look at them, and I think they're unnecessary.
Thank you, Representative. Further questions before leaping back to Representative Crummell? Representative Crummell, it's back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back on the third page again. At line 38, it talks about, and the read-in line is that when people have received the information required under Section 2, that they can't disclose the information to, you know, anybody else other than the youth, the youth's parents or guardian, the principal, and school employees or school subcontractors notified under subsection 2 or 3 of this section. So, does that mean that everybody that's been notified of a particular student will know that all the other people were notified and will know who was notified and that sort of thing? And again, that may be one of those sorts of questions that somebody else needs to answer, Senator, and that's fine if that's the case. I can come back to it.
I don't know if it does say that. I don't know. That. Are you saying so the teacher knows, the PE teacher knows, and the bus driver knows, and they get?
Yeah. So in other words, if I were a teacher that got notified that Billy has a problem, would I know that you were a teacher that had been notified also, or would I know that the bus driver on bus route 17 that drives Billy's bus knows? I'm just trying to figure. What I'm trying to figure out is how the administrators are going to be able to put this into play and into place, and that's why.
If I can jump in, and Senator, please correct me if you think I'm misinterpreting this, but it seems to me that this bill does, it gives the discretion to the superintendent to make the decision on how that communication is going to be passed into the school. So if it was felt as necessary to say, well, I need the drama teacher and the PE teacher to know, and I need them both to know because they share classes or whatever, then they'd have the discretion to do so. But as I read the bill, there's nothing that says that the requirement must be that if I'm telling Representative Comp, I also have to tell Representative Roblin that Representative Comp knows, if that answers your question.
I guess what I'm driving at is the confidentiality issue, Mr. Chair, because if I don't know that another teacher or another person is on the list and knows, and I start talking about that particular student, have I breached their confidentiality? And if I have, then, and it would be unintentional,
correct,
but maybe I thought that they, that teacher or that person was on the list that had received the information, and it turns out that they weren't. And
well, Representative Kremel, I would say that this is absolutely no different than the 8 or 9 other categories of disclosure that must be made regarding things from health care to custody in the corrections department or psychiatric review board.
Okay. And then follow up, Mr. Chair?
If you can do one more, then I think we're going
to... And that's fine. In your mind, Senator, what would you consider to be, because on page 4 it talks about things in at the top of the page, lines 1 through 5, that for, you know, the stuff may be used for, not for, the act may not be used for admission or disciplinary decisions concerning youth unless a violation occurred during a school function or on school property. What would be considered a school function, and what is going to be considered school property?
Well, I understand there'll be rules to delineate those kinds of things, but we're trying to get at in this section, and this was added in after a series of work groups, which I think made it a better bill, was to take care of school fights, in the playground, high school, a dance, after dance, you know, crimes, those sorts of things, so that you don't have a catch-22 situation.
Okay.
And I might add, Representative, that we did work this bill through a series of work groups, and I know the parties spent a good part of last weekend narrowing the focus of this bill quite considerably. And with help of the Juvenile Rights Project, they probably don't appreciate me saying this, but they actually worked to make this a better bill.
I sure come. Thanks.
Just a comment, and I'm sure Representative Roblin, I beat you to the draw for a change. There are already standing rules on definitions of what is a school function and on school property.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions for Senator Hass? Senator, thank you so much for being here.
Thank all of you.
Appreciate your information. I think we'd like to. I think this is going to be. Is this next? Okay. Alan Bruner, Ginger Redlinger, and Melinda Adams, and Lori Wilmer Whalen. There's four of you. You have to kind of play musical chairs there. Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. I'm Melinda Adams, and I'm employed by the Salem-Keizer School District as a special needs school bus driver. And when I first saw this at the OEA last year, I went to Ginger and I told her, I says, you have to make this broader than just the classroom. I drive a school bus. I have been attacked on the school bus trying to get a student off of another student. I have been bit, scratched, kicked. I've helped helped other drivers get a student under control. It's, you know, I've had a student put on my bus that had been kicked out of school because of violence. He hadn't been prosecuted or anything. He was put on my bus. He made all the students on my bus nervous. He made me very nervous. He sat and picked, this is a middle school student, sat and picked scabs off of his knee so they would bleed, and told the other students on the bus that he liked to see blood run and that one day he was going to hurt somebody so he could see their blood run. I went to the teacher that as soon as I dropped him off, and I talked to the teacher. After that, we were able to get that student off my bus to where he wouldn't be around other students. He was transported by himself to school, had a one-on-one aide for a couple hours, and then that aide rode back home with him to where our students were protected and our drivers were protected. Because I mean, I've seen too many children traumatized, afraid to get on the bus because of something that's happened on the school bus. When I worked for the Albany School District, we had a driver that was attacked driving the school bus. Her shoulder blade was broken, and she had permanent damage done to ligaments in her arm. And she was driving when she was attacked. No one told her that the student that they put on her bus had violent tendencies, and that the student had came from another district. My job as a bus driver is to keep my students safe, to get them to school safely, and to get them home safely. When I drove a large bus, my very first day of driving school bus, I had a fifth grader in the back of my bus with a cigarette lighter and a can of hairspray. And there was flames going across the back of my bus. And I thought to myself, what did I get myself into? I've been driving for 12 years, and I love my job. And I love the kids on my bus. And I want them to be safe. I want students that have got themselves into situations to be safe on my bus. You know, I want to keep them safe from other kids attacking them, setting them up for failure. Safety is our biggest concern on the bus. And as a special need driver, every year we go through training on confidentiality rules, keeping all the information confident. We don't talk to each other about things that goes on. You know, a lot of times we take breaks, go to restaurants and stuff. We don't talk about it, you know, because who knows, this could be a relative of a student on our bus. We know that we can lose our jobs. Because if we break confidentiality, we deal with medical issues with students on our buses. You know, we keep that confident now. So, you know, another piece of information to keep our kids safe and to keep us safe is worth it.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenham? I think that it's okay to let the panel speak and then come back.
Your pleasure,
sir. Thank you very much.
Hi. For the record, my name is Ginger Redlinger. I teach at Oregon City High School. I've been in education for 17 years. Chair Buckley, vice chairs, and House Education Committee members. I'm very proud of my school. I have been in education. Well, I'm sorry I said that already. Part of my school, all of my students, my colleagues, and our local law enforcement agencies and our social service agencies in the county. Collectively, they have helped me understand the issues deeply enough to appreciate the impact of this bill and how difficult it is to come to a resolution and how it will make school safer for everyone. First, I would like to thank you for considering Senate Bill 1092. Thanks to all the collective work done to revise this bill, it is now more workable for all parties. Educators believe we are taking an important step together to ensure that schools remain as safe as they are now. Making simple, common sense changes to the notification laws in Senate Bill 1092 will not diminish the opportunity for second chances. The changes may rather increase the likelihood that the second chances will be successful, and a smooth transition will occur in a safer environment for everyone. The current laws let too much time pass before people are provided the information they need in order to keep schools safe. Senate Bill 1092 makes important safety information available to schools in 48 hours rather than 21 days. It also addresses the concern that current laws prevent people who have the information from sharing it with people who are responsible for ensuring a safe environment for all. It also provides as much privacy for students as possible, which we all support. I will quickly share the story of how I came to be here today. And let me add that while I had done research on this since last year, no private or personal information about a student was ever shared with me, just the events that happened. From August 2006 to April 2007, I gathered information about these issues based on a few incidents that occurred in my school and in other Clackamas County schools. In April, when educators from around the state gathered at the Oregon Education Association Representative Assembly, I made a motion that we make changing the notification laws a legislative priority for this session. When 600 people from around the state agreed, it confirmed that it was indeed an issue of critical importance to all educators. During that representative assembly, I heard the following stories. The one which we've already referred to, the bus driver suffered permanent damage in her elbow ligaments from a violent student. She had not been notified. She would have taken different steps had she known there was a risk of being attacked. Two teachers from Wilsonville shared their stories. A student, this is one of them, a student who they later found out was convicted of sex crimes, was grooming female students. After 3 weeks in class, one female student told the teacher that the other student was making her and the other females at the table feel uncomfortable. When the teacher asked the administrator about the student, she was told that no information could be shared, but thanks for the heads up. The next day, the student in question was removed from the school, and the teacher was not notified. She was later told the information after trying to find out what happened to the student who disappeared. The teacher stated, "Had I been notified, I could have watched for generic behaviors, notified someone immediately, which protected the female students from the few weeks of grooming they received or they were exposed to, and maybe prevented the student from making another mistake." The second teacher told of a student who threw furniture, and while no one was hurt, the potential for serious injury remains. She did not understand why someone who is known to be that violent is allowed to stay in class. Property damage occurred. Due to the student's violent outburst, she does not feel that she has a safe or secure environment, and neither do her students. The students selected to make up this classroom are students of families who do not interact with the school very often. So students do not go home and complain to someone who will do something about the situation. She feels as though she has to provide for the safety of her students. If she had more information to work with, she might be able to do things differently. At Southridge High School in Beaverton, a student who transferred into this teacher's class, within 10 minutes, a fight had broken out in the back of the room. The transfer student had a history of violence, and the teacher had not been notified. She would have seated him differently in class if she had been notified. At Canby High School, violent events occur between students in different places in the building. Some of these events, reported by a gang task force officer, are related to intimidation and gang recruitment. Teachers told me, if we had been notified of the potential for violence, we could have been more proactive in monitoring places in the school to ensure all students were safe. In the last 2 years at my high school, here are some exemplary events. One student transferred into my classroom on the day we were using Bunsen burners. He gleamed, but told me he shouldn't do the lab. When I questioned him, he told me he had just been released and was on probation for arson. Had I been notified, I would have made accommodations so he could still engage in the learning activity. But I would not have placed him in a situation that compromised his confidentiality, endangered himself or other students. When I talked with the administrator later, he said he was not allowed to tell me due to the notification laws. Another event. A student who had a history of violence subjected a janitor in our building to verbal abuse and ongoing harassment. Had she known to watch for certain behaviors from this student, she would have sought help instead of trying to handle it on her own. Had someone not intervened, the student may have escalated the situation into a physical attack. Also this year, a student enrolling in our district commented that he moved here because the law enforcement agency in his California city said that if he left the state, he wouldn't be prosecuted, but if he stayed, he'd be looking at 20 years. The nickname for this practice is Greyhound Therapy. This is an issue that should be addressed in the future since it shifts students who have committed but not been convicted of violent crimes from state to state and no information is available to the school where they will enroll. When I asked an administrator in my building if this was the first time they had heard of such a thing, he said no. This is not only an issue for schools, but of shifting law enforcement responsibilities and costs from one state to another. This particular issue will require a fix in Washington, D.C. I merely bring it to your attention as an issue of concern raised by many people around the state. While completing research on the issues of notification, I learned that in Washington and California, students who are convicted of felonies and violent and sexual crimes that complete sentences and are released back to the community don't return to regular schools. They will still offer the free and appropriate public education, but in alternative settings. I learned and have confirmed in my own conversations with adults and students who came from these states that they come to Oregon because Oregon does not have this law. The issue here for me is notification. It can take 30 to 90 days for the information from another state to arrive, and so much can happen in that time frame, like the examples I shared from Canby, that is imperative to the safety of our schools if the laws be changed. In April, the education community asked me to come and share these incidents with you. So too have teachers, county mental health workers, law enforcement representatives, bus drivers, instructional aides, janitors, community college workers, and administrators from around Oregon who have shared their stories and encouraged me to work with the elected officials to increase the information available to everyone so they can help all students be successful and ensure that schools remain the safest place for all students. We need your help now. In closure, educators are trained to help students grow. We have provided medical information, academic information, personal information necessary to help all students be successful. We are trained to keep this information in confidence. With this information, we help students learn amazing things about themselves, the world around them, and the community in which they live. We gladly work with all the students we are given. It is our calling. We provide an academically rich, environmentally safe, and secure environment. Educators remain committed to helping students receive a second chance. We desperately need more information about students who need additional supports to be successful and decrease the likelihood that they will repeat mistakes. We know that keeping schools and classrooms safe is a priority for everyone. And lastly, making simple common sense changes to the notification laws in Senate Bill 1092 will not diminish the opportunity for second chances. The changes may rather increase the likelihood that the transition will occur in a safer environment for everyone. Thank you for your time.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, my name is Alan Bruner. I'm a 19-year high school veteran teacher, and I'm coming here today to speak on behalf of your supporting Senate Bill 1092. As you've heard repeatedly stated, this is an issue dealing primarily with safety for those individuals who work with Oregon students. For me, I'd like to frame the discussion in the following way. I am a manager of education, but I'm also a manager of about 150 students. Unlike elementary teachers who deal with perhaps 20 to 30 or more students at one time for an entire day, because I teach at the high school level, we deal with multiple classes. And in those multiple classes, we have lots of personalities coming in and out. In some of our discussions about rights and responsibilities of what students can and cannot do, I'm very familiar with and use a lot the phrase in loco parentis, meaning I'm their parent. As long as they're in my classroom, I am their parent in whatever shape that looks. That means that it is my responsibility to keep them safe and keep the environment in which they learn safe. So a piece of Senate Bill 1092 is framed to make sure that all in the education profession have the opportunity to do just that. Whatever their locale and whatever the venue they have their students in, that they have the ability to keep those students safe. I know one of the concerns here in this room has been expressed. It deals with confidentiality, and I understand that. Because every time I open my computer screen to take roll in my classrooms, I see medical alerts. And in fact, if I were still in the medical professions, we would be talking HIPAA law all over the place in terms of what I have access to. Yet when I do an environmental studies class, it's important to know that the one young lady who was out nearby a tree might have an allergic reaction to poison oak or poison ivy. More importantly, that hornet's nest that's active around this young lady's leg may cause for a response on my part to inject her with epinephrine should she suffer the allergic reaction I know she has the potential of having. More importantly, I have one young lady who is a diabetic who is on a pump, and I know because I work with her in multiple venues that she's well-monitored, well-maintained. She knows how to deal with her blood sugar. But we've had people in our drama cast, for instance, who've had to inject her with insulin because she and I were able to say, yes, this is a need. Yes, this is documented. And yes, you have the authority to do this. The information we're asking for in Senate Bill 1092, we believe, is of a similar nature. It gives us the opportunity to maintain student safety, maintain an environment, but still provide opportunities for students to grow and thrive in. I'd like to share one event that happened at my school, which truthfully scared the heck out of us, and dealt with a young man who came from a neighboring state. He started at the beginning of the year, was in my global studies class at the time. And despite all of our best efforts as educators, just did not seem to fit in. And trust me, in a small rural environment, we have the luxury of being able to spend a lot of time with kids, trying to get inside their heads. What do you do? What hobbies? Are you involved in sports? What do you do recreationally? And so on. We're also trained to look for behaviors of drug or alcohol abuse, and this student exhibited some very classic behaviors that teachers are educated in looking for. And so when confronted by our principal at the time, the young man became belligerent, his backpack was searched, and inside was a small baggie of what later were identified as prescription medications and a very large hunting knife similar to the type that's used by special forces. As a result of our laws for weapons on campus, the young man was expelled and was enrolled a few days later in a private Christian school several miles away from our campus. The last time we saw this young man, he was across the street at our local marketplace, and he solicited one of our students at lunchtime to buy drugs. To buy prescription drugs. What brought it to the attention of our principal again, though, was the fact the young man had a 9mm handgun sitting next to him and was brandishing it and showing the gun off. And so our student, scared to death, told our principal, who contacted our local county authorities, who wound up making an arrest at the Christian school's parking lot without incident. It came out later that the family had moved from neighboring state primarily to give their son a second chance, another opportunity to get rid of behaviors that he had exhibited, similar behaviors. What we're asking for is the opportunity just to have information so we can be more alert, so we can, with respect and with confidentiality, be aware of the fact that we have potential threats in our classroom that could endanger the lives of other students. Senate Bill 1092 passed the Senate, and again, as you've heard testimony, a lot of work from a lot of parties represented in this room recrafted the bill to make it fit the needs and very legitimate needs of all parties concerned. What we're asking today is that you, as the Education Committee here, pass it on for a vote. It's an important piece of legislation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, if you may.
Please.
First, I'd like to ask Ms. Adams, what if you had known that that young man with the lighter and the hairspray had been arrested at some point, although not convicted of some X, Y, had gotten in a fight, had been charged with attempting to harm a fellow student, case was dismissed, but now you know that. How would that have helped you handle the situation that he was sitting back there with a cigarette lighter and a can of hairspray?
First of all, it was a young lady was back there. But
good. It's a gender neutral.
Oh yeah, it ranges all across the board. If I would have known, then, you know, I would have kept her closer to the front, because at that time I was in a large school bus, and she was about 30 feet behind me, and it was very difficult to see what was going on. And, you know, I wouldn't have made her sit up in the front seat, but she could have sat within the first few seats, you know, just so I could have kept an eye on her, talked with her, you know, not put her in a predicament where she's felt like she was punished, but at least I would have known not to let her go all the way to the back of the bus.
Thank you. If I can follow up, it's basically the same question. Let me ask each of you. It strikes me that you're raising cases that turn out to be serious cases. The young man with the hunting knife and others. And in healthcare, we had a lot of trouble dealing with the question of making sure everybody in the world gets tested for HIV so any health professional can know how to be safe. And instead, we taught them how to be safe. We created universal precautions and taught them how to deal with cases, whether or not the person was HIV positive. It sounds to me like many of these cases wouldn't be changed much, except maybe by excluding them from school, wouldn't be changed much by the knowledge that somebody had been arrested, the charge was later dropped, or they weren't convicted, so they were arrested for something, like threatening harm to another student. And now, I'm not sure how that's going to help you in terms of dealing with that student's need or the other student's safety.
Well, I'll just take an example. The students that have told me, that have told me that they're on parole for one thing or another, I have never sought the information. They've shared it with me openly.
We're not talking about convictions here, though.
No,
we're talking about arrested, but not convicted.
The student that shared with me that they were here because the state told him to leave. His law enforcement agency in California told him to leave. If he didn't, he was facing 20 years. He was in my classroom. I didn't ask him why. I didn't treat him any differently. But what happened with all of those students is I lost them because I didn't have enough information to help them stay. And that's where it would be different than a medical situation, in my mind at least. Like, for example, the student with the Bunsen burner, if I had been told in advance, I would have set up, and a word that we use in education is differentiated instruction, which means you offer more than one activity with a different level of learning so that students have more than one way to complete an activity. I would have partnered him up with someone that they did the fire part, and he would have done the regular part, the data analysis piece, or I would have used a hot plate instead of a Bunsen burner. I would have done everything I possibly could to make sure that he learned the science that was behind what it was we were doing and not had to violate his probation. But I wasn't privy to that information, so I couldn't set it up that way. I felt like I had let him down. It's not going to be a universal fix. It's a little more information that helps us help these students who need a little more help be successful.
Thank you, Representative. Can I follow up on that? Just see if I can. Thank you so much for your testimony. And if possible, get a copy of your written testimony. I appreciate it. From your testimony, the examples that you're citing, these are examples that right now, under current law, cannot be communicated or are not being communicated.
I would say are not being communicated for whatever reason, and I think that administrators are doing due diligence to make sure they're protecting the confidentiality of the situation. So, they're doing what they think is right, and they're frustrated because, according to the administrators that I've talked to, they would like to be able to share more information. They trust the teachers can handle the information, but they feel like they're in a quicksand. If they do, it's bad, and if they don't, it's bad. So if the notification laws were changed, it would make the environment better for everyone. Just one more piece of information.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What are the age groups making most of the troubles in the classroom or in the bus? Are they younger or more older? What are the age groups?
It really doesn't seem to be the age groups. I mean, I've had kindergartners that I've had to kick off the bus because of behavior problems and stuff. And I transport preschool all the way up to 21 years of age, everything in between. The thing that I see, what happens mostly, is it's behavior that they've learned or they've copied from other kids, and so then they wind up doing it. But, I mean, we wind up expelling lots of elementary kids off our bus for several days, middle school, high school. It's just straight across the board.
Okay. Just one more question.
Thanks, Representative. Yes.
I'm trying to go to the source, not necessarily to the direct student. Mm-hmm. When such a student having a bad behavior, having guns and knife, whatever, it seems to me some kind of an environment they were in, just such as at homes or some other places. It seems to me more responsibility for their parents. So, of course, we need to address the students in trouble or bad behavior, but we need to go to their home circumstances, why such things is happening. I think there should be a closer that their dialogue with their parents or their guardians, whatever.
Right. This Saturday I was talking, I have a 16-year-old daughter that goes to high school in Albany, and I asked her, I said, if there was a student in the classroom that had a behavior of violence, I said, would you want the teacher to know? And she said, most definitely, I would want my teacher to know. She said, that way the teacher can keep me safe. And I asked her, I said, would you want the bus driver? Because she rides public, she rides a school bus. And she said, of course I would want the school bus driver to know, so I would be safe. Then I asked her, I said, would you want to know? And she said, part of me would want to know, but she said, I really don't want to know. She said, because if I knew, then I would treat them different. And she said, kids are mean enough as it is to not, you know, to do things to other students. She said, so students don't need to know, but we want to be safe. We want to go to school and feel safe. And then she said something that just blew me away. She said, if nobody knows, nobody can help. Her father committed suicide the 1st of January. And she says, Mom, I want the teachers to know and my bus driver to know. She says, if I break down, I want them to know so I can leave class. She says, but I don't want to know my students, my other friends to know. She says, because they'll treat me different. So she says, if nobody knows, nobody can help.
Very smart.
I want to respond from the
please, teachers. If you can, briefly, we have other people who want to testify. I want to try to get as much as I can in.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, in educational psychology, Alfred Bandura speaks to looking at social behaviors even as little kids. Famous set of experiments that I teach in my psychology class deals with a inflatable doll and little kids that are, you know, observing adults doing violence to this doll and then watching as the kids mimic the adults. What you're commenting on perhaps is a societal issue.
Yes.
It certainly is out of the hands of what we do day to day today in the classroom, outside of the issue of enculturation, looking at what is polite behavior, what is non-aggressive behavior, what's acceptable, what's not. In a pluralistic society, we in fact are put in a situation of saying what's the lowest common denominator that we'll tolerate. And that, in fact, is exactly what happens here in Salem when the House and Senate pass laws about what we will say is acceptable behavior and what's not. As a society, when we wind up looking at these incredibly big issues, they become very complex and very overwhelming. And everyone has, if you will, a dog in the fight when it comes to expressing their personal rights. A piece of the discussion even today deals with that issue. How do you protect the rights of one individual who has made a mistake, who has been accused, perhaps even paid for that mistake, and counter that with the rights of safety and protection of the other 149, for example, who are totally unaware of the one? That really is the issue, and that's why in the crafting of this bill, all parties need to be represented. All parties need to have their particular issues represented. But when it comes to the issue of, you know, what makes us a violent society, I mean, that's philosophical.
Probably resolve it this afternoon. But yeah, you frame the issue very well for us. I do want to hear from the folks who also have their dogs in the fight as well.
And I want to thank you. I know that you all understand it's a very complex, and I appreciate the time, the due diligence that you're exercising here with this, because it's important for everyone.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the work you do as well. Thanks for being here with us. Ms. Mulwellen, did you want to add comments? And members, just for your information, we won't be voting on this bill today. I want to get as full discussion as we can on it and look forward to your thoughts on it as well. We'll have this scheduled again tomorrow. We do have the kindergarten bill as well today, but I want to give as much time as possible I can to get to this bill and make sure everyone has a chance to talk on it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the Oregon Education Association. I will be very brief. I handed out an explanation of 1092 of the -3 amendments. It's a chart that was designed to track for you the work of the work groups you've heard Senator Haas and others mention. I just thought, as a kind of a technical point, you would be wanting to know the kinds of things we did to bridge the gaps and do what we could to come halfway with folks who had objections and also just concerns, liked the bill but wanted it tweaked in one way or another. And so this is a tracking list of all of the groups, all of the concerns that we were able to address in our amendments. And that doesn't mean that all of the concerns were addressed. These are the ones we were able to address in our amendments. And the bill that came to you, Senate Bill 1092A, is reflective of how the Senate voted on that. They passed the -3 amendments in committee, and we came from the Senate floor with a 28-1 vote. I will stand by at any point to answer any of the technical questions you may have, but in the interest of time, I don't need to go into any of the details at this point.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are they fairly brief? Because I want to get the other side's point of view
should
as well.
Should be pretty brief.
We'll go to Vice Chair Wisner first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your opinion or what's your position on these other amendments that we're looking at, Lori?
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Wisner, yes.
6, 4, 5.
We believe that we have come so far with the amendments that we have made to date that either the A5s, which gut most of our bill, the A6s, which add a level of confidentiality that I think you will hear from the school community would be very burdensome, and the A4s, which would create a task force in lieu of the bill before you today, are all unacceptable for us.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the purpose of Section 15?
I forget my bill, please.
I mean, it says that the amendments to ORS 338, 025, and 115 by Sections 12 and 14 of this Act don't become operative until 2017 and 2017-18 school year. Why Sections 12 and 14?
Yeah. Is there an administrative clarification after you listen to the Senate?
I'm sure Lori can answer this as well. It relates to the implementation date for charter schools. And I don't know specifically why their date is different, but I know that that is.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I don't know either. I think the legislative counsel attorney who wrote this is in the room and may be able to answer.
In the room, she was
a minute ago.
That was an excellent catch, Representative.
Yeah.
We'll get clarification.
And it was actually not something that we requested, so I don't know the answer to that either.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Can we have Mark McEchnini and Kristen and Andrea Meyer, please? Andrea, right ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ann Christian. I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I indeed will be brief. Mark from JRP, Juvenile Rights Project, will carry most of the water with regard to concerns that we continue to have. But I do want to say that as a representative of attorneys who represent both youth and criminal defendants, and an attorney who has not practiced law for over 20 years, when I looked at this bill, I thought, what is it that the proponents are trying to accomplish in this? And maybe with age, it took me a longer time. And finally, when I met with the actual proponents of the bill, it became clear to me that there are two aspects of this bill. One can look at this bill and break it into two different parts. And one part is sections 1, 2, and 3 that we all are concerned about. The remaining sections address existing laws, laws that are already on the book, where, for example, a young person who is on probation, existing law already requires the juvenile departments to send a monthly list to the school districts with all of the kids in those schools who are on probation. And so I kept thinking, what is the issue here? And for that second part of the problem, I believe the proponents are asking for the ability, at least the clear ability, for school administrators to pass that information down to the teachers and the school bus drivers. So today I would say to you, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers does not have a concern with those sections of the bill. Our concern is merely with Section 2. Section 2 of the bill would create a new provision so that a district attorney or a juvenile department, at the point at which a child is just charged or accused of a crime, the DA, let's say the DA, would be required to notify the schools. I am all for safe schools. Part of the concern and what really turned it in my mind was the two individuals in Yamhill County who recently were charged in juvenile court originally with what was a felony sex offense. Felony sex offenses. And over a period of time, and I'm not casting judgment, I mean, this apparently has happened a number of times within that county. So over the period of time, that felony sex offense was reduced to a misdemeanor and ultimately dismissed. Our organization has a strong opposition to having the notification to the schools at the point at which an individual is merely accused. Existing law for youth who are charged with the most serious, they're called Measure 11 offenses, your existing law already provides for notification to the school when a child is charged with a Measure 11. It's already in law. So I thought, since looking at this bill and finally realizing that there are two aspects of it, I like puzzles, and I thought I would just share with you that this bill, our opposition is very limited. It's to sections 2 and 3. Working with all of the good people over this short period of time, what I would be requesting, and I do want to clarify something that the previous individual in response to Representative Wisnant's question about the amendments, there are three amendments. The A4 do not gut the bill. The A4 would delete sections 1, 2, and 3, the ones that my organization are concerned about. And rather than a task force, we would maybe as an alternative request that the committee put together a work group during the interim. So this amendment, the A4, would allow the rest of the bill that at least, I don't speak for the other two up here, but the rest of the bill that we don't have opposition to, that could go forward with the notification going farther to the teachers and the bus drivers. The A5s are very similar. What the A5 amendments would do is remove sections 2 and 3, the ones that we have difficulties with, and allow the rest of the bill to go forward. And the final, so I did want to correct that the A4s and A5s, which are our amendments, are not intended to gut the bill. And finally, the A6 would deal with confidentiality. It's a provision that I found in the Citizen Review Board existing laws that we thought we could just carry over to the school situation. So with that, I'll end, and we'll continue forward. And if you have any questions.
Thank you very much.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I am a social worker at the Juvenile Rights Project. Our office represents roughly in the neighborhood of 2,500 children and youth in Multnomah County each year who are involved in the juvenile court system. That includes children in foster care and youth involved in the juvenile justice system. As an adjunct to our court representation, we also do a substantial amount of work in the schools on behalf of our clients. And actually, I was sitting in the audience thinking how I'm going to both attend an IEP meeting for a student tomorrow morning and be here by 1 o'clock in case I need to be here for the carryover of this bill. As Ms. Christian said, we are concerned about the notice to schools that would occur simply on the basis of an allegation. As frankly, it's been a struggle to get our minds and our hands around both the problem as described by the proponents and the proposed solutions. And I wanted to quickly review, because I think that this is an issue that some of you were struggling with during the previous testimony, is even in the face of stories that are alarming and shocking and troublesome, we must ask, what is the connection between those problems and the proposed solution? I've actually thought, teachers have continued to challenge me somehow, even though I've left school. But this this debate has caused me to think back to my eighth grade algebra teacher, Mr. Rim, who was very memorable because he wore avocado green short sleeve button-down shirts and wide broad orange striped ties, and he had his hair brill creamed back and had the horn-rimmed glasses and even wore little rubber thimbles on his fingers to keep the chalk dust off of them. And the main thing that I remember from Mr. Rim is that we had to show our work. We had to show how we arrived at the answer that we provided to the problems that he posed. Even if we somehow ended up with the right answer, we had to tell him how we got there. And that's really because if we ended up with the wrong answer, he needed to know why we got the wrong answer. He needed to be able to correct our work in a way that helped us understand and learn. And my greatest struggle with this debate has been getting from the stated problems to the proposed solutions, and how, in particular, the new law, the first part of this bill that broadly expands the notice beyond the existing law to include allegations at the very beginning of the juvenile court process, how that would resolve the stated problems. And I have listened to testimony similar to what you have listened to this morning, and I frankly do not see where many of those circumstances would have been avoided or remedied with the notice based upon an allegation in juvenile court. Many of the examples given were explicitly stated that youth were on probation, which means they have been adjudicated, which means school districts have received notice. They receive notice if the student remains in the same county. They receive notice if youth move from county to county. There are provisions for notification to transfer from state to state if families of youth who are on probation move from state to state. So for all of those cases that were cited that involved youth who are on probation, there are existing notifications already in place. And I believe this goes back to Chair Buckley's question about was the notice prohibited or did it just not occur? And clearly the law allows the notice to occur, but for various reasons that notice may not be happening. I think the one potential example that did include pre-adjudication notice potentially was the California example. Frankly, it's hard to know without more information and more detail about the circumstances of that anecdote exactly what occurred and why. And I believe Representative Crummell pointed out the logistical problems in expecting that other states will provide useful information, even if an Oregon school administrator has the time and the ability to call and ask for it. I would also like to point out that we do have school records that are supposed to follow students. So any behavior that occurred in relationship to a school setting should be recorded. There are all sorts of paperwork that are involved in disciplining students, and those, I can assure you, can be found in student records because our office has the opportunity to request those for our clients. And those records should be following students in a timely manner, whether they're moving to a school in another neighborhood or across the state or in another state. The incident on the bus that Ms. Adams described was actually very troubling to me, but I did not see the problem as being the problem identified as driving this particular legislation. My concern is that there are special education students out there in our state who are already identified and are not receiving adequate services, and that includes training for staff that should be part of their individual education plan and a description of their behavior that anyone who works with the student who needs to know should know. But again, I see that as a different issue than this bill addresses. I realize you're pressed for time, so I would just...
Please, I want you to feel free to get the chance to say anything you want to say.
Okay, thank you very much, Chair Buckley. I would like to briefly walk you through my written testimony. I realize it's several pages, so the first three pages are a summary of our... We have several different concerns with the approach that this bill takes. I've already talked about the problem with expanding the notice to pre-adjudicated or unadjudicated youth. And on one hand, there is a philosophical reason for that youth, like all of us, are or should be presumed innocent until proven guilty under our system of laws. But there's also a practical problem with using that information and assuming that it will be meaningful and useful when it is provided to schools. You can see that the amount of information is very limited to the charge, the name of the student, basic vital information. That information, again, leaves out the context in which the behavior occurred, which is the very context that the juvenile court will be examining and weighing as the adjudication process proceeds. And is, as Ms. Christian described, often charges that are originally levied are very different than the charges that ultimately result from adjudication. Often, there is some gamesmanship in an adversarial legal system where the prosecution is trying to seek the most severe charge and severe penalty as a strategy, and the defense is trying to get the least severe penalty and charge also strategically. So part of this game is the levying of the charges in the first place as a tool to extract a plea. charging high in order to get some kind of admission or adjudication later in the process. So the charge itself is very likely to be misleading information and not telling about what the youth's behavior was or what their needs are overall. But even further than that, research has shown in evaluations of risk assessment instruments, including in Multnomah County, where the county has worked to try to reduce the disproportionate detention of minority youth who are overrepresented in the juvenile justice system as well as in school discipline in many areas. And so they sought to use an objective risk assessment instrument to determine which youth really need to be held in detention for public safety reasons and which can be released to the community because they don't pose a significant risk. And I think everyone, including professionals in the field, assumed that it was just common sense that the severity of the current charge was indicative of risk and was a reliable indicator of risk. But what the evaluation of that assessment found was that it was not. It actually, through a longitudinal assessment of youth who cycled through the juvenile justice system, found that it actually gave the backwards impression. It indicated in the wrong way. It inflated the risk of those who scored high on that item of the seriousness of the charge, and it gave a false impression as well of those youth who scored low because their charge at that time was a lesser charge. And when they looked at those youth who were assessed originally and looked at their actual behavior later on, they found that that was not a reliable indicator upon which to assess risk, and they have subsequently dropped that item from their risk assessment instrument. The last three pages of my written testimony are actually provided to me by Dr. Kevin Moore, who's a psychologist in Eugene. He has worked for the Oregon Youth Authority, the Oregon Social Learning Center. He's worked in schools as a school psychologist in California and Oregon. And he, in a much more research-oriented way, describes a similar problem in terms of using one bit of information about a youth to draw pretty broad conclusions about what their behavior will be in the future. And when you're looking at incidents that, while some of them are shocking, are not everyday occurrences, the challenge in trying to predict that behavior at any given time based upon a very limited amount of information becomes virtually impossible. And his argument was that you would be correct more often, more of the time, if you just assumed that no students would commit acts of violence in a school setting than if you picked out a few students and said that they will commit acts of violence in the school because of this piece of outside information. So I think he reinforced, I can't remember who made the comment right now, but the idea that really training, I believe it was Representative Greenlick talking about HIV prevention and identification, really not being able to predict who the troublemaker will be at any given time, you're much better off training staff, in this case teachers and other personnel, just to be careful, to be skilled. You know, just like health workers are trained to wash their hands and use rubber gloves and take caution, school staff should be trained on how to handle difficult situations. And in particular, learn that no matter what knowledge they have about a student's history, learn the responses to behavior that are more likely to de-escalate the situation and the student's behavior rather than increase the likelihood that students will become more violent. And he cited a review that he did in one of his programs and found that in situations where staff were hurt, he could identify something that the staff could have done differently in every single circumstance to avoid that situation. Really briefly, the other piece of my testimony is in the middle of the chart. And frankly, this has also been a struggle in discussing this bill, whether in committees or work groups, is that the proponents of the bill have claimed in their written materials, I found all of these on their website and included testimony provided in committees, that current law prohibited the sharing of information about youth with juvenile histories. And that's clearly not the case. Clearly not the case. And then the argument has changed that it's sort of been flipped on its head at this point, where this bill doesn't make big changes because it doesn't really change what the existing law is. But I think we need to think about the bill in two pieces. There is the part that essentially clarifies what the existing law is in more explicit language, although the language ultimately has a very similar result. But it clarifies that, and if that is helpful to the schools, I think that is fine. And again, the amendments do not change those sections of the bill. What the amendments address is the much more problematic proposition of making a radical change in juvenile court practice, where mere allegations about youth that occur outside of the school context must be reported, or required to be reported, to their schools before anyone has a chance to really weigh the evidence or the youth has a chance to respond. I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, and I truly will be brief. We join with the OCDLA and the Juvenile Rights Project in our opposition and concerns that you've just heard. I want to make two notes. There's been some discussion earlier that this is simply public record and all we're doing is providing public record. There's a lot of things in public record that exist, and unless someone knows to ask for something, it's not quite as public as we often think of public record. And so by way of saying that, what I'm saying is I don't think just because it's public record we should then be easily providing it to folks. Maybe not the best analogy, but you've certainly seen this with folks who are released after sex offenders. Just having that public record that they were a sex offender wasn't sufficient, didn't have the right effect. There's notice given. So there's a real difference between having something exist in public record and going out and affirmatively providing it to people. And there's repercussions of that. My other comment is simply a technical one, that if you do go with creating a task force or anything else that does list the American Civil Liberties Union, I'd appreciate it being the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon, as that is our proper title. So also, I want to clarify, Ms. Christian rightly brought forward earlier an example in Yamhill County, the issue of many felony charges. I just want to clarify, because we've talked about it a lot, but I think she felt that was, for lack of a better word, the spanking case that I think everyone in the state heard about. The youth in the school who were charged with the felonies, and eventually those felonies were dismissed. And that's an example where there are repercussions, and it's important to move very carefully on this and have more discussion during the rest of the interim. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll leave you some questions to take a couple minutes here. If any of the panel could clarify for me, when we talk about the Measure 11 offenses already being triggers, just to clarify, those triggers are triggers on when the youth is basically arraigned for that crime, that the schools are given that information now on Measure 11 crimes?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Ann Christian, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. If you'll look at page 4 of the bill, and it is section 4, so page 4, line 16. This is existing law, ORS 339317. No later than, currently it's 15 days, and the bill would amend it to 5, after a person under 18 years of age is charged versus convicted,
right,
charged with a crime, and 137707 is in fact Measure 11, or is waived under a number of provisions. Even if a child is not charged with a Measure 11 offense, current law allows a child to be, it's called waived, sent from juvenile court to adult court if a judge makes certain determinations about the nature of the offense and the nature of the youth. The court, even if it isn't a Measure 11 offense, can say you're going to adult court. And in both the Measure 11 and the waiver situations, existing law already requires notification to the schools.
And if I could follow up, please. If a child is between the ages of 9 and 14, they would not be charged under Measure 11, and presumably there's a strong possibility a 9-year-old would not be moved up to an adult crime level. So would these crimes that are listed in Section 2, would these crimes be new crimes and notification for that age group?
Mr. Chair and Christian, I'll try to respond to this, and Mark is more involved in the practice. Indeed, individuals who are less than 15 years of age would not fall within the Measure 11 provision. And I'm uncertain with regard to waiver cases that the courts actually have any set age level above which or below which they determine whether or not to waive. So I'll let Mark address the second part of that question.
Chair Buckley, I would like to reiterate that I'm not an attorney. But
Ian is.
But I'm not practicing. So.
I think the... I hope you don't take this as dodging your question, but I think what I would like to add is the practical aspect of what happens in the juvenile court. Okay. There are some counties that do prosecute younger youth between 9 and 11. Not every county would typically do that. We have in our juvenile system the ability for petitions to be filed on those youth and even older youth up to age 18 as dependents of the state, and that they would be addressed through the foster care system through DHS, and that is more likely to occur with those younger children. It's very extremely rare that children that age commit the kinds of crimes or alleged to commit the kind of offenses that I think the advocates for this bill are most concerned about. So it's a practical non-issue in most cases. And the other practical piece of this, I think, and I wanted to make sure I get this on the record because I know this is the Education Committee, and you probably don't discuss the juvenile code very often or talk about court practices or procedures very often in this particular committee. That there is a procedure, and when we talk about the youth's first appearance in court, the primary focus of that hearing is to basically formally make the charges. The judge appoints an attorney for the youth at that stage for the very first time, and the primary discussion in most cases is what will happen to that youth in between that court hearing and when the charges are resolved. And it's at that stage, that first court hearing, which especially for serious charges is most often the very next court day, so 24 hours, 48, 72 sometimes, if we had a holiday weekend this week. Some youth who went into detention on Friday may not have a hearing till today. But for the kinds of serious charges that are being discussed in relation to this bill and the need for the bill, the courts have very broad authority and honestly exercise that authority on a regular basis to detain youth who pose a risk to the committee, to the community. Excuse me, a little slip there. You are part of the committee, the community after all. Pose a risk to you or anyone else in the community. And there's actually presumption that the judges need to find that the youth doesn't pose a significant risk to the community in order to release them, and they need, and they can also create parameters around the release. If a youth is released in our county, they have electronic ankle bracelets that they use for juveniles. Some are placed on house arrest. But those who commit violent offenses are very likely to be detained, which means they're not going back to their neighborhood middle school or high school. They're going to school in the detention facility. And frankly, even those who don't, even the, you know, if a younger child acts out, and whether they are handled through the delinquency system or the dependency system, and they do something more serious, if they act out sexually or violently, they're more often going to be going to a treatment facility where, again, the schools are on site, work directly with the treatment program. The staff work side by side. They have plans. They share information about those kids. So they are in those contained settings, not in the average public school.
Thank you very much. Representative Greenlee?
Yes, sir. A brief question. If you can help me understand the page 2, lines 16 through 19, that A section under 4, that talks about harm or threatened harm, including criminal homicide, assault, or any attempt to cause physical injury. It's including that, but not limiting to that, obviously. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say limited to that. So let's parse those out for a moment and talk about what it might mean to threaten harm of any person in an attempt or any attempt to cause physical harm. What, I mean, could that be fight at a basketball game somewhere?
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlee, it's very broad. I mean, I think that goes without saying, and I would answer yes, it could be the fight. It could be misdemeanor offenses, I think, of like harassment or menacing, that are not individuals actually engaging in physical fighting. Because it's
all those guys used to do to me, huh?
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlee, I don't know about that.
A lot of menacing, I remember. That's high school, right? No, this is a serious question. And that really seems like a very broad...
It is.
It's a charge of something that could be any number of things that would then get into the school information and... without any adjudication, without a judge suggesting that happen or anything else.
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlee, that's exactly our point, is once the youth is, it's called adjudicated, convicted, then we have no opposition to existing law, which has the schools notified. The concern is simply with Section 2 and the pre-adjudication.
Representative Clint.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Clint.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know if the charge is menacing or harassing? Are they covered in what then would be reported or no? Is it just the Measure 11? And, you know, I mean, I know there was some debate about the level of severity and that the bill's been scaled back and that some people say Measure 11. It seems like we talked about delivery of alcohol, something you all didn't think was really a Measure 11 crime, but still in the bill. So harassing, menacing, I mean, those are pretty common charges that happen in a school bullying situation or something. Would those be covered by this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, and I trust people will correct me if I'm wrong, it happened this morning. Those are charges that would be included in this bill. Specifically, you mentioned the alcohol or drug offenses. That's at page 2, line 26 and 27. The first part...
That one I'm not worried about. I was giving your example. I'm asking specifically about menacing and harassing.
And Representative Clem, I would say that menacing and harassment would be possibly included under the harm or threatened harm to another person, any attempt to cause physical injury, just as Representative Greenlee and I were discussing. Please keep in mind, however, that once a youth is convicted and put on probation, regardless of whether it's a Measure 11 offense, so let's say just a menacing, and not to say menacing isn't serious, but if it's a menacing, current law once the youth is found guilty, current law requires the juvenile departments to notify schools on a monthly basis of all of the youth who are on probation. So that already should be occurring.
Well, if I might, I'm particularly interested in the people who are accused and then it's acquitted or dismissed. Mm-hmm. When you talk about the McMinnville case, they were charged originally with felony sexual something.
Right.
That got dropped. So how would this bill work with that kind of students? They're charged, then later dropped as part of the whole plea bargaining thing that we talked about. You know, a notice had been given. Is a notice required to be given that the charges were then dropped later?
It is.
I mean, sure. Everyone in the country knew about that one, so I'm not so worried about that one not getting public. But
Chair Buckley.
It was probably Measure 11 anyway.
Please, go ahead.
I think it started then.
So it was going to be.
But it was.
Well, Chair Buckley, Representative Clem, it may not have been a Measure 11 if they were younger than 15. But I think, the answer to your question is yes, this bill includes a requirement that a subsequent notice go to the school if a youth is acquitted. Our concern is the practical application of that requirement. One, in ensuring that our concern is that the diligence for reporting the offenses may be more diligently followed than the follow-up in terms of the outcome for those cases that were dismissed or where a youth is acquitted. And I think the other thing is you can't really erase people's memories. And our concern is with the labeling and stigma that may occur when youth are accused of things and the word is shared, but then they are later found that they didn't do that. It's hard to erase that impression that was made in people's minds. And I think that's another point that Dr. Moore's written testimony goes to, is the way that people treat you differently once they find out negative information about you. They tend to more likely to avoid you and behave negatively towards you than if they have good feelings and positive feelings about you. And even with correction in that information later, we wouldn't always assume that everything would go back to normal and that would all be forgotten, and that's a concern to us.
We're going to Representative Roman for one last question, then we'll wrap up for today and come back.
And I guess mine's as much a statement as it is a question. It appears in your testimony, kind of, the assumption is this knowledge is going to, in some way, negatively impact the children whose the information has been given on. And I can understand that it could. But I will tell you that if you listen to the teachers that came up, and if you know most of the teachers that I work with as the principal, and my own personal belief, most of the time they want the information so that they can do their job better. And part of it is we train teachers a lot. I mean, when you're talking about the training that we do, we train teachers a lot on how to handle situations, how to lower the tension. Many of them are exceptionally good at it. Others don't have as many skills, but I would assume that's true in any profession. But, you know, I came to high school, and I always like history, and I look back, and the principal that was the longest there in the 50s and into the 60s at our school was a revered principal. And he made the point of going to the police station every Monday morning before he came to school to see what had happened on all the public information. And then he would meet his students who had not been appropriate during the previous weekend and explain to them that that's not how people at our school behave. And it created a very positive impact in a whole lot of people in our community. And many of them who are parents came back later to say, you know, I only did that once, but when this person came by and talked to me, I thought, I'm never going to have that happen again. And I think that part of this is about giving teachers the opportunity. These students are going to be under a lot of stress because they've been charged with a crime, even if it's going to come down. And stress causes different reactions in people. And teachers who know that understand how to deal with that stress and to alleviate some of it, to stop by and pat the kid on the back and do some other kinds of things while they're going through that. And so from my perspective, as you heard these teachers come up before, all they were saying is give us the information so that we can use the skills that we've been trained to interact with these kids and help the whole school not only be safer, but have those kids be able to learn better. And I guess when I look at this, I see in here, and I see in the testimony of the teachers, and I know how it worked for me. I mean, as dean of students at my school, when I was doing that part, I knew a lot about kids that they shared and the police shared and all the stuff that was public information. And oftentimes they knew I knew, and across the room you could just look at them and give them a little smile, and they'd calm themselves back down and recognize that, you know, we're going to get through this stuff together. When they don't have the information, it's hard for them to do that. And I guess I just like your response, because I heard that in the testimony more than I heard that they were wanting to know it just so that they could put them in a special place or do something with it. There's more that now I have the tools that I need to interact with that child and make it his experience better while he's here under all this pressure.
Chair Buckley, Representative Roblin, I appreciate your comments and the opportunity to respond. As I mentioned, we work quite closely with schools on behalf of children who are already involved in the juvenile court system in one way or another. And we certainly see the kinds of responses that you describe. And there are certain schools, certain principals, certain teachers that we are very grateful when our clients are educated in those settings by those people. And I think the teachers and who have spoken on behalf of this bill are the conscientious, high-performing teachers. But we also see other responses by educators that are more across the board in terms of from high-performing to very poor-performing. And I think that's part of the concern, is that the responses, you know, creating a policy that is across the board can't control the responses that will result from this policy. And we can't be sure how exactly individual teachers and buildings will respond to these students based upon this behavior. And we certainly see some students who have a reputation and they really get no slack from teachers. They don't get the encouragement. And I think they are disciplined more readily when they do something wrong than another student who doesn't have that, already have that kind of label or reputation in the school. And that's part of the concern, is that even though this bill explicitly says that students shouldn't be disciplined, when a report comes in on an incident that occurred outside of the school property or ours, and outside of the school context, our concern is that they will be disciplined more severely or more readily for the very next thing they do that may be a little bit out of line. And again, there are some dedicated, well-trained teachers. I mean, I have many teachers who I remember and I will remember for the rest of my life. And again, some teachers I'm very grateful that our students are being taught by. But there are some teachers that I had and some teachers that our clients have that basically survive the experience with those people. There is a broad range within the teaching profession and my profession, the social work profession, and the legal profession, and every profession. There is a broad range, and this bill does not control for those factors.
Get the last word here before we
Chair Buckley and Andrew Meyer. Two things, and I often don't speak personally. I'm only going to say that I had an experience in school where there was something false about it, and it was impossible to put the genie back in the bottle. And so that's the experience I had, and that's the concern I think we're talking about. I want to mention, you know, when we talk about youth in crisis, and in many cases, or some cases, parents are involved.
Right.
And there's nothing that prohibits the parents, if they're worried about their kid in emotional crisis, be it because of a death, be it because of charges, to talking to those teachers that they feel it's safe, or the school principal, when they feel it's safe to do so. Those ones who really want to help the kid and work with them. But there also may be situations where the parent has reasonable belief to go that's not a safe place, that's not going to be useful in this situation. And so it gives them the discretion when there's a crisis situation going on. I don't want to lose sight of that issue.
Thank you for that response. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your testimony, members.
Thank you
for your attention. We will hold this bill over till tomorrow. We'll be hearing again tomorrow. We'll start with the kindergarten bill tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Hopefully, I haven't heard much discussion about it. There won't be. But then we'll move on to this one, try to move both bills tomorrow.
Just a closing comment for, I'm sure all the committee feels the same way, but I want to thank everybody that testified today because they truly care about our children.
Thank you. That's an excellent comment. With that, we're adjourned.
Questions?